Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello there, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Today's a special day. This is a special show. It's called the Moolala Book Club. Today we are going to talk to authors, only authors, about their books. I'm really excited about it, in part because I've written a couple books and I know how much work it is. So I'm jazzed to talk about the people who have devoted their time to making a difference in the area of personal finance. We're going to start with a new book called Worry-Free Money, about a new approach to money management that lets you enjoy spending your money, enjoy it responsibly. Then there are so many resources on personal finance matters. It can be difficult deciding what advice to take. We're going to talk to an author who believes you can fit all the investment advice you ever need on a single index card. In fact, that's the title of his book, The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. I love it. And we're going to talk to the author of a book called Working with the Emotional Investor. Money managers offer logical reasoning when it comes to investment decisions for their clients. But of course, a person's emotions can play a really, really big role in their investment decisions. So we're going to talk about the role psychology plays when it comes to money. Plus, beyond the piggy bank, the basics of parenting can take up so much time and energy that remembering to teach your kids about money can easily fall to the wayside. We're going to speak to the author of a book who focused on that, and he kept it simple by creating a checklist of the important financial areas to cover when teaching children about money matters. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Whether you make $30,000 a year or $300,000 a year, it can feel like you're constantly broke. Can you afford the car, the vacation, the night out, let alone groceries? You think so, but it can feel impossible to know for sure. Our next guest understands that. She works with lots of people who are dealing with those kinds of questions. Shanalee Simmons is a certified financial planner and the author of Worry-Free Money, a guilt-free guide to managing your money that also lets you enjoy spending it occasionally. Hello there.
Hi.
Guilt-free. That's a big benefit to a lot of people out there.
Yes.
So tell me, why did you want to write this book? Because you and I both know it's way too much work. It's like a stupid idea. Listeners, never write a book.
Don't
it's too much
book.
Work.
Yeah.
Why did you decide you wanted to write a book?
Because I'm on the front lines of financial planning and have been for a decade. And especially in the last like 5 years, I noticed that, like you said, like regardless of someone's financial situation, whether they were swimming in debt or actually had lots of savings under their belt, there's this like constant feeling of broke. That word kept coming up again and again. Mm. And people are feeling like the middle class is feeling frustrated and squeezed, and they're starting to give up on some of their financial plans. And I noticed that the more broke and frustrated or guilty or whatever that we feel, the more times we feel that way, the more likely we are to just like throw in the towel.
Right. We're not guilted into virtuous behavior.
Exactly.
We're guilted into throwing in the towel and saying,
Screw it, right? Like there's no point. And
right.
So the book is something that I wanted to write to tell people like, hey, first of all, everyone feels like this. So it's not just you. You're not bad with money.
Right.
And second of all, what can you do to make it really not intimidating and not something that makes you want to throw in the towel so that you can actually move your finances forward?
You start with a story about a fight at IKEA. Which that's a universal story. Anybody's been in an IKEA with a spouse or not has those feelings. How does your personal experience inform your view of money and therefore what you decided to write?
Yeah, I think that I'm a person just like everybody else. And for all of the financial savvy and know-how that I have, that doesn't mean that I wasn't on the verge of tears in an IKEA because I couldn't get the couch I wanted, right? And so I think that was an important moment for me. Was like, I know I can't really afford this. I know I shouldn't buy it. And all the shoulds, right? I should appreciate what I have. And I shouldn't want this couch and all that stuff. And yet still I found myself getting really frustrated that I couldn't afford it because it made me feel broke. Because if I just had a little bit more money, I could get the thing that I really wanted. And so in that moment, I see that same kind of behavior and the same kind of like words coming up with clients in financial sessions. And I'm like, we're all the same.
Yeah.
We all, whenever we feel these certain ways, we feel inadequate or we feel broke, we feel frustrated or tired. This is when our finances take a big hit. And so having that personal experience is just like, I mean, I have those experiences all the time, but that IKEA fight is just so that moment where I felt like such an idiot. But at the same time, I'm like, this is real. I feel upset about this couch.
And you did never get that designer couch. You have the IKEA couch still.
Still have the IKEA couch, which is lovely. And that was that's the turning point, right? Is like, in that moment, because of some of the knowledge that I have about how to make a quick decision about affordability, whether you can and can't afford something right now on the spot, I know it. And the perspective to be like, hold on, hold on. Why am I feeling like this? It's because I feel inadequate because all of my other peers from Bay Street have fancy couches and I don't. That's what makes me want this couch. It's not that I actually need this couch.
What is your quick equation for affordability? Because that's a question you and I get asked all the time. People don't know. What's the quick way?
It's okay. So for me, it comes with how you set up that banking plan, right? So for me, if you've followed the strategic banking plan that I've nicely...
Is that a phrase from your book?
Nicely laid out for you, yes. then the money that you have in your spending account is money that you can like blow to zero on whatever you want. There is no rules with it. So it's one of those quick check-ins. Is there money in the account? Yes or no. Can we go to Chicago? Is there money in the account? Yes or no. Can we do this? Yes or no. And so by isolating money that you're allowed to spend guilt-free, then you kind of create permission for yourself to spend it on whatever the heck you want to.
So in the couch example, it would have required that you'd saved money so that there was money in the account, that there was the $2,500 or the $3,000 to buy that designer couch.
Yeah. Or, and so I also am realistic because most people, when they want to buy a big purchase, they haven't really pre-thought about it. So I usually say, is it something that you can comfortably and realistically pay off over 6 months if you have it on a credit card?
Right.
And I might be raked across the coals for that because I'm saying like, hey, it's okay to use a credit card. But I'd rather give people realistic boundaries to use rather than to be like, never any credit. And then people use credit, they feel guilty, and they feel like they're bad with money.
I won't rake you over the coals for that.
Well, thank you.
And 6 months, I think, is a good time horizon. What people don't do is think about any deadline.
Correct.
They just think it's going on the credit card, and someday, one day, a unicorn's going to come and pay that off for me. You have one section called Stop Budgeting, Start Living. What this one is sacrilege.
No, it's perfect.
Tell me.
Okay.
No, I actually think you and I are going to have a similar view. I think when I read it, I thought, oh, yeah, we're on the same page.
I know. So the one thing I've noticed, though, if people come in for financial advice, again, even if they're like, I just want to make sure we're on track, that's a big question I get all the time. Like, are we on track?
Right.
And so one of the things that people do when they want to feel financially responsible is they turn to budgeting, right? Because budgeting has been heralded as like the answer to being financially responsible. It all starts with the budget and all that kind of stuff. Well, traditional budgeting and the way that it usually works and what I see on the front lines is like people have come in and they categorize their expenses into these microcosms, coffee shops, takeout, dining.
They're
out.
Tracking. They're not they're, budgeting. They're tracking their money.
They're tracking it. But then the budget comes in the fact that they take these tracked expenses, forecast out what it should be. So, okay, I want to spend $80 a month at coffee shops, $20 a week. I want to spend this much on groceries. I want to spend this much on clothes. And then what happens is, so that's the budgeting part. And then you're supposed to live within that trajectory for the next however long your budget is for. And so what happens is when you have these little microcosms of expenses, our lives change week to week, day to day. And so 1 week, you might only spend that $120 on groceries that you had budgeted. But the next week, you might be hosting your family and maybe you need a lot of cheese.
Yeah.
And so like the budget just goes right out. So then what happens is people start, I'm saying this in quotations, borrowing from other categories. Well, I'll steal from the coffee fund to add it to my clothes fund. And all this does is keep money right on the forefront of our brain all the time, making us feel like we're constantly tripping up. Alert.
You're one big failure.
One big failure all the time. Oh, alert, you overspent here. Oh, alert, you overspent here. So you're not overspending as a whole as a person, but you feel like you're constantly stumbling and that you can't do anything right with your money.
So what's the option?
Yeah.
What's the option?
So the option is to just have one line in the sand. The only quote budget that you need is like money that you can and money that you cannot spend every pay period. That's it. So once you figure out what all those bills and fixed costs are and you put aside money that you want to do for like what I call meaningful savings, which is anything that kind of increases your net worth. And once all that money is kind of put aside, then whatever is left over, we isolate it in a separate account or something like that. And then that's your money to blow to zero between now and the next pay period. And that, I don't care how you spend it. I don't care if you spend it on, so you don't need to track it and you don't need to budget it as long as it's kind of within, I call it your hard limit. So as long as it's within that hard limit, know your limit, spend within it kind of thing.
How do you say no to feeling guilty? And I love that you're a new parent. You have a 6-month-old.
Yes.
I am a parent. It's a whole other category of wonder, being our producer, Aaron, is a parent.
Yeah.
He's looking on here. Guilt is, it just kind of goes with the territory.
Totally.
So how do you minimize it? So the example you use is around kids' birthday parties. You live in a neighborhood, everybody spends $500, and you're going to be the one that has the party in your basement with, you know, dollar store plates, really?
I know. And that's that whole concept of the inadequacy issue that I talk about and unhappy spending, and when we do it just out of social obligation, right? So that is prime. If you are spending money on something that you feel is an overspend, you're doing it for the wrong reasons, and that's why you're probably feeling guilty. So how do you say no? Well, you start having having really frank, honest, open, transparent conversations about money, no matter how hard that it may seem. And the example that I use is a great one because a lot of people resonate with that birthday party. So this one client was like, I can't keep doing this. She was spending literally hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year on other kids' birthday parties, including her own. And she was, you know, ours were considered cheap. And so if she had an honest conversation with the other parents, hey, look, I can't afford this anymore. We're trying to save for a family vacation. I can't do this anymore. What's possible? And every other parent, she was shocked, was like, oh, us too.
Let's do the toonie thing.
Let's do it. So just starting that conversation is really important to opt out of the guilt.
Making financial lemonade. What does that mean? How can people use that?
Okay, that's my favorite chapter in the whole book, actually.
Oh, I love that I picked your favorite chapter.
Yeah, it's my favorite chapter. Okay, so we all have made past mistakes. Lots of people are still in the situation where their current financial situation might be lemons. So the whole idea of taking lemons and making lemonade with your finances is like letting go of any past financial regrets that you might have, letting go of the fact that things didn't really work out maybe the way that you planned them to, appreciating what we've got right now and being creative so that we can pull those levers of like income and expenses to try to make it work now, how it is that's realistic for your life so that you still feel like, hey, this isn't so bad. Like, I'm actually okay with how it is. It's, you didn't like lose the game. You just kind of changed the way that you're playing. Do you know what
right.
I'm saying? So it's taking what you've got, appreciating what you have, letting go of what you don't have anymore, and kind of shifting your perspective to say, like, my money situation is not that bad and I can make this work. It's hope.
Yeah. And a little bit of sugar. You need a little bit of sugar in that lemon. Lots of sugar.
Yeah.
Shannon, thank you very much for coming in to see us.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon Lee Simmons is a certified financial planner and the author of Worry-Free Money, a guilt-free guide to managing your money that also lets you spend just a little bit of it.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are countless personal finance resources that offer a wide variety of advice on everything from investing, saving, to retirement and taxes. But University of Chicago professor Harold Pollack believes you can fit all the investment advice you'll ever need on a single index card. Harold is one of the authors behind The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. He joins us now from Chicago, Illinois. Hello there.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book came about back when you were challenged to share your best financial advice on a single index card. Why that challenge? How did that come to be?
Well, you know, I was obsessed with personal finance because I had a family tragedy that sort of made me very focused on money. And as part of that, I would talk to people who, you know, were experts on personal finance, who'd written books about it, things like that. And one day I was talking to Helene Olin, who wrote a book called Pound Foolish. I was talking to her about it. And just I flippantly said, you know, isn't the fundamental problem facing the personal finance industry that the best advice for most people is available for free at the library and it would fit on an index card? And we kind of chuckled and we moved on. And then I started getting all these emails saying, well, where's the index card?
I need the index card. Give me the index card.
Yeah, of course, I was speaking metaphorically, but I had, you know, I had made a statement and I had to back it up. So I just reached into the drawer, you know, in our kitchen, pulled out a 4x6 index card, scribbled down 9 rules, took a picture with my iPhone and posted it on the web, and it got 400,000 hits.
Oh, my God.
And it was, it probably took me, you know, 2 minutes to write the thing. And it was, it actually won one Money Magazine, you know, one of their best new ideas of the year. And of course, I'm at the University of Chicago where all these real financial experts, and they looked at my card and they just said, you're kidding.
Right. We've been working for a decade on research that will get us tenure and research dollars. And you write something on an index card and put it on Instagram. Really?
That's exactly right. That was exactly the reaction that I got. But there was something about that that people found very helpful because it takes all these really intimidating tasks about saving for your retirement and says you don't have to understand all that stuff. You just have to kind of follow these rules, which you can kind of look at on your refrigerator. And people found that helpful.
We're going to go through many of the 9, though probably not all. Let me ask you this. It's a terrible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you have a favorite? I know these are your 9 children. Do you have a favorite? Just tell me. I won't tell anyone.
Well, I think that that probably, I guess I would say don't buy or sell any individual stock. Because the great thing about that is that it's anyone can follow that. And all the data is, we're all so terrible at playing the market. And it's just, that's the simplest. I would say that's my favorite. Probably if I give a second favorite, you know, sort of like your kids, you know, you say, well, this is my favorite, but this is my, also my favorite. I would say save your money. I said save 20% of your money, which for a lot of people is really hard. But, you know, rocket science is a lot more fun when you have rockets, and investing is just a lot more fun when you've got some savings there.
So that was number three and number four. I tell you, my favorite is number five. Pay your credit card balance off in full every month. And I love that because while it's hard to do, the notion and the rationale behind the notion are so incredibly simple. And the guaranteed return is so profound. In fact, if I could, if I had to take it from an index card to a, I don't know, a postage stamp, I think I'd pick your number five.
That's a pretty good one. I, you got me there.
Yeah.
No, it's a risk-free, tax-free return for most people of like 16 or 20%. There's nothing that you're going to invest in if you're not named Warren Buffett that's going to get you anything close to that.
Now, your number one is maximize your retirement savings. We call it – we have a different phrase up here for retirement savings than the 401k. We call it an RRSP. Why was that number one? Should I interpret anything into that? Is that the top priority, or is there an order to these?
Well, I must say that to a great extent, the order was what came into my head in those 2 minutes.
Right.
The good thing of that one came to my head very early because it's a mechanical thing that anyone who has a sort of salary job is confronted with, and it's a great way of just making it automatic and taking this money out of your hot little fingers where you're tempted to spend it, and also where you get the employer match. So that jumped into my head right away for that reason.
One of the rules that is harder to wrap your mind around is number eight, make financial advisors commit to the fiduciary standard. What is another way of saying that? And how does the average person, Canadian American, how does the average person follow through on that rule?
Oh, you have a very polite but explicit and blunt conversation, which is you say to your financial advisor, do you commit to dealing with me as a fiduciary in all of the investments that I have with you? And the idea is the fiduciary is under a legal obligation to maximize your financial well-being. It means that it typically means you're the only person who's paying them for the advice that they're giving you. You know, if you don't have that fiduciary standard, you're often speaking with a salesman. And, you know, there's a lot of things that salesmen, a lot of really great things that a salesman can do for you. But you don't walk onto the Ford lot and say, do you think that I need a new car or should I drive?
Can I just drive my old beater? I know you're having a sale, but I should probably just stay with what I've got, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's not the person you want to ask. And, you know, financial advisors, we often think that they are giving us unbiased advice when they're not. And I must say that when I wrote this down, it's amazing how many of my friends and relatives said, I have a great financial advisor and he's free or something like that. And of course, my heart always sinks.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. I don't know if you work for free, but I typically don't.
Yeah.
And you know, if it's free, you're the product. And almost always when I start to talk to people about their really cheap or their free financial advisor who is not a fiduciary, they would be in investments with high fees or there would be something going on that just was not in their best interest. You just want to have a very straight up conversation. And at this point, all the advisors, they've had this conversation a million times before. If they're uncomfortable about it, that's a red flag. You just talk straight up about it.
Number nine is unlike any other on your list, and it is promote social insurance programs to help people when things go wrong. It sounds, well, in America, especially in these times, it sounds like a very political point versus a, you know, sort of thing you can check off your checklist. Why did that make the nine?
It's interesting. A lot of people complained about that and said, you know, you gave me all this, you know, sound advice and then you got all political.
Then you had to get all communist on me.
That's right. Well, you know, I think it would be dishonest for me not to have number nine on. The reason that I wrote the book, or, you know, they started the book with Helene was you know, when I was a newly tenured professor at the University of Chicago, my mother-in-law died suddenly, and her son, my brother-in-law, who is intellectually disabled, moved into our home. And he was 340 pounds, and he needed to be hospitalized, many times. And we would have absolutely been bankrupted if it wasn't for Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. And I think particularly for an upper-middle-class professional like myself, it's very easy to give other people advice about how you should live like I do with the resources that I have. And if you're struggling, it's because you suck,
right.
And the truth is that I just, I relied on the American taxpayer to rescue me in my hour of need. And, you know, we can protect each other against these catastrophic risks that would just crush any one of us if we had to face it on our own. And I felt it was really important to honor that. If you get cancer, it doesn't matter how good of a job you've done saving, you're going to need help to pay for that. And that's all part of the mix too.
It's interesting, as a Canadian and working on a Canadian show, we so take for granted the social safety net that we have. We still complain about it and the wait times and the rah, 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 and people not pulling their fair share or whatever. But we do have a layer of support that isn't common around the world. And I know from when I lived in the U.S., it's not unfortunately not common for you in the country that you live in.
No, Canada certainly has work to do itself. I've done some health services work up in Toronto, and there's certainly gaps in the Canadian safety net, but there is a sense of fundamental security that you've been able to provide that we could really learn from in the U.S.
Well, thank you for helping us learn from you and the index card. I really appreciate you taking the time, Harold.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for your flexibility.
Yeah. Harold Pollack is the author, one of the authors behind The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. He joined us from Chicago. Stay with us. Coming up on the Moolala Book Club, How Human Emotions Can Drive Investing. We talked to the author of Working with the Emotional Investor, a book about financial psychology for wealth managers. And later, Beyond the Piggy Bank, a book that helps parents build their kids a framework of financial education that covers everything from allowances to banking. You can follow me on Twitter at Bruce Sellery, Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Sellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. I'm Bruce Sellery. Today we're talking about books, money books, financial books. Here's our next one. There are a lot of factors to consider when making an investment decision. Logic, reason, and a financial roadmap are all good things to consider. But in many cases, a person's emotions or life experience can actually play the biggest role in their investment preferences. That's the focus of our next book, Working with the Emotional Investor, Financial Psychology for Wealth Managers. The book's author, Chris White, joins us now from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello there, Chris.
Bruce, how are you?
I'm great. You begin this story with a very personal story of losing your treasured governess. Why did you decide to begin there? Why was that important?
Well, that occurred right about when I was 8 years old. And as it turns out, in working with a psychologist who works over in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 8 years old is a critical time for people growing up. They often go through what's called a loss of, it's like what the psychologist calls the perfect love. And that impacts how that person sees the world, as they recover from that and rebuild themselves through adolescence and early adulthood. And it clearly colors the view of money, of risk-taking, of loss, and the need to win.
So how does that connect to you? I know we're starting with you and we'll expand it out to investors at large. But for you, what was the connection to that incident and how what role emotions play in how you invest?
So a psychologist, and his name is David Cantor, came up with basically three personality types. He calls them hero types. They are the fixer, the protector, and the survivor. And I have a very strong tendency to be the protector.
Hmm.
And it's really, you know, it's born from a desire from my experience to protect myself. And in the worst situations, I tend to feel powerless, and as if, you know, other people are doing things to control me, so that I feel like a victim. And all of those feelings in that dark zone, if you will, and we call that the dark zone in the book, are directly applicable to investment decisions.
Does that mean that would it be correct to then assert that you're a conservative investor, someone who leans towards fixed income or wants to, you know, buy and hold, more interested in those kinds of things than growth or riskier asset classes?
Perhaps if I weren't self-aware, I would tend to be more conservative, but. You know, having been through business school and understanding the importance of risk taking, and so I have a mental overlay, I'm able to consciously move away from that protective position, excuse me, and consciously move into taking risk at appropriate times. So I have many clients in the great financial crisis of 2008-2009, who were protectors. And the typical protector response in that market downturn was, in feeling powerless, you want to sell everything. You have to get out. You can't stand the pain anymore. And that response is very appropriate for the protector. Being aware of that in myself, I would often need to go in and counsel these individuals, know now is not the time to be selling. The market is just getting near the bottom. The Federal Reserve has started to take actions in late fall. Be patient. Hang in there. Don't jump off the ledge.
Mm.
You know, let me call you back from the ledge.
Yeah.
I understand your pain.
I mentioned the title here. You're really talking about financial psychology for wealth managers versus the investors themselves. How well equipped is the financial advisor community on engaging with clients in this way? Because it is a very different skill set than PE ratios and interpreting the durable goods data.
Well, it is left brain, right brain.
Yeah.
And so it's a part of the work that I love. I love both the left brain and the right brain. And I can talk, you know, relative PE ratios until the cows come home. But you need the training and the sensitivity and the ability to hear with that third ear what the client is telling you as the advisor, or even to listen to your own voice. And what you're thinking, what you're saying, because it has a very powerful overtone to influencing decisions.
Mm.
And I would say that not a lot of people are trained in this. I know, I mean, where I went to business school at Columbia in New York, that, you know, they've got some programs now that are beginning to address these issues. So I think that improvements are being made, but I think we're really at the infancy.
What do you mean by the word emotional? There is so many layers to that word. And in the context of investing, what do you mean? And I ask because I think there's a risk that some people might think they might use the catchphrase, well, don't be so emotional. Don't get wrapped up in the emotion of the markets. But I think what you're acknowledging is that that's a fundamental for all human beings walking on this earth. It just manifests itself in different ways.
Yes. And in fact, The person who's saying don't get emotional is often expressing a feeling himself or herself.
Right.
So they are emotional, but they're very upset about it. They don't like to look at it. They want to wall it off. And that personality type is the fixer, the first type, who has a very difficult time with affect. The protector is very comfortable with affect. The fixer is very uncomfortable with affect. The fixer can, in the light zone, where stakes are low, can be very charming. But as it gets darker and darker and the stakes get higher, they become controlling and manipulative. These are all emotionally driven behaviors. So, don't get emotional on me is really, I think, just the person expressing a discomfort with the fact that they also are emotional. Mm.
I'm going to ask you a very difficult question, and that is this. If you were to arm or equip financial advisors, wealth managers, with one question that you believe would, I know you're laughing already, one question that would unlock an emotional key or provide something to help a client manage the emotional journey that they're on as it relates to investing, what would that question be?
Well, it's an excellent problem that you've proposed here, is how to unlock that. And I've found that often the question that provides a lot of mileage is the question, what is the purpose of the money? Mm. Because you can then, in asking that, you have to be very attuned to body language, to voice, to tonal delivery, as well as the words that are being used by the client, and that will help lead you to additional questions as you go down through the layers. But that question, what is the purpose of the money, is really a critical one.
Yeah. Chris, I wish we had more time to speak. I appreciate you joining us today.
Well, it is my pleasure. This has been a delight to talk with you. And if your listeners are at all interested, please have them go to www.chriswhiteauthor.com. And there's a website there that has much more material on the book.
Excellent. Chris White, author of Working with the Emotional Investor, Financial Psychology for Wealth Managers. Coming up later on the program, the Moolah La Questionnaire. But next, Beyond the Piggy Bank, a simple plan for raising financially capable children. Author Clint Greenleaf has some pretty tough questions that parents need to be asking themselves. If these books aren't enough to add to your reading list, I've written a couple myself. You can order either of them online. The first one is called Moolah La, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do With It. Do About It. Ooh, I got the title of my own book wrong. My God. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I have a 7-year-old daughter, so I am really, really interested in this next topic. Kids and Money. Clint Greenleaf is the author of Beyond the Piggy Bank, Raising Financially Capable Children. He joins us now from Austin, Texas. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, thanks for having me.
You have an Abby. I have an Abby. Perfect. Now, I want to ask where this interest came from for you to focus on kids and money. You started as an accountant. You ran a publishing company. Now you're a peanut butter entrepreneur. Then you had kids. Was that the catalyst for you?
It really was. So I sold my publishing company, and I took the obligatory trip to Hawaii with the family.
Of course.
And as I'm sitting there, I look back at my daughters, who at the time were 4 and 2. My newborn son was on my wife's lap. And I look back, and of course, we're all in first class because I had some extra miles to burn. And I had this realization. I thought, oh, my God, if I don't pay attention, these kids are going to be entitled little monsters through no fault of my own, more just my ignorance of how to teach them about money. But as a CPA and someone who's always taught my employees about money, I probably have to do the same thing with my kids. So what's the best next step to take to teach my kids about money?
You started with a book, a riff on the Three Little Pigs, which is adorable. What were you trying to do with that?
Sure. So I researched about 50 different books on the topic on how to teach your kids about money, and each one of them had a different angle. Some people say give allowance. Some people say don't. Some people say if you do, tithe to chores. Some people say don't. And the only real common theme I could find was a give, save, spend concept. Mm-hmm. And that's where you teach kids to spread their money among those three concepts. So I gave my daughter three piggy banks and said, here, let's get these, and you can put give, save, spend on each of them. And she looked at me and said, Dad, it's the Three Little Pigs. And I said, no, that's a different story. You're conflating two different ideas. And she said, no, Dad, it's the Three Little Pigs.
Kids are smart. And
they really are, right? So a friend of mine did the illustrations for Dora and Little Mermaid, and he's kind of a big wig in the Disney art community. And I asked him to help me do the illustrations for this book, and it was a sequel to the Three Little Pigs story. On my daughter's advice, that it's really how to teach kids the basics of how to give, save, and spend with their money.
You have a worksheet associated with your book for grownups that I love, and I love it because it's comprehensive, it's values-based, and also the parent is accountable. Because what you hear from a lot of parents, and I speak on this topic out there, and they'll say, this should be taught in schools, this should be taught in schools. And I don't know about you, but my view is that a large portion of it isn't so much taught in the home, but it's modeled in the home. And I feel like your worksheet really puts the focus very clearly on the parents. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. Whether you want to or not, you're teaching your kids about money. If you constantly say, oh, God, it's Monday morning and I have to go to work, I'm so angry about this, your kids are not dumb. They're going to pick up on that. And if you tell your kids, wow, I'm really excited, I get to go on a business trip and I'm going to spend some time making money for the family, and I'm going to learn a lot about how I can be a better boss and a better dad and a better husband. Now they get excited about that sort of thing. So whether you are or not, you're aware of it, you are certainly modeling for your kids constantly.
One of the questions you ask in this worksheet is, when will you push your child to get their first job? First of all, what's your answer? And second, what's the purpose of this specific question?
Sure. So a good friend of mine, Jerry Bell, is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and he's a expert on the topic. He's interviewed hundreds of thousands of different people and has found that the number one predictor of success is somebody who had a job outside of the home by age 10. They did something. Yeah, exactly right.
I just was covered in goosebumps there. I've only got 3 years. Oh, geez. Okay, go.
Well, here's the good news. Now, it's pretty easy to do. They have to answer to someone who's not you. They have to do something that is not pleasant, and if they don't do the job, they don't get paid. You get bonus points if the job, forgive the language, really sucks.
Mm.
If it's something where you're shoveling something that came out of another living being.
I did that.
Yeah. If you can paint houses, if you can wash dishes in a commercial kitchen, something that really is terrible. And it has a multifunctional tool on that. One, you teach kids that there are jobs that are not necessarily pleasant. Two, you teach them the value of hard work. And three, if you were a lazy kid like I was in high school, you teach them that maybe they should stop being lazy and start working harder, or else they'll do this job that they don't necessarily want to do forever.
One of the audiences that you speak to are presidents, senior leaders of organizations, people who have really all the money in the world that they can give to their kids. How do you find they react to this message? Because I know a lot of people in this circumstance, their kids want for nothing, and it is way more work to have them go out and get a job when they can easily just open their wallet.
Right. And the thing is, it's really a short-term solution to open the wallet. And I think a lot of people assume I can outsource things like changing the oil in my car, so why would I not outsource this? Or why don't I let my kids learn about it when they get older? And the same way that you do potty training, kind of as soon as you're ready to do it and as soon as your kids are ready, you want them to make that lesson as soon as possible, kind of fermented in their mind or cemented in their mind. You also want to make sure that they have the time to make mistakes. So a lot of presidents assume, my kids will learn about it in college. I don't really have time to deal with it now. And I don't want to, you know, cheapen my vacations. I don't want to fly coach to teach my kids.
Right.
Coach. So I'm going to.
They're only a child once. They should have the joy of a summer of leisure.
Yeah, exactly, which is such a cool idea, but it doesn't work in reality. So I'm a big fan of saying, look, you've got to vaccinate your kids against entitlement, and you got to vaccinate them against the difficulty that comes from just wanting to give them everything. You love them, but the same way you make them walk on their own, the same way you make them get potty trained, you're forcing them to learn something that might not be pleasant, but is certainly a functional part of society, whether they want it to be or not.
Another question, will you allow your child to quit their job? What do you mean by that?
Right, because... Yeah, so here's the thing. Sometimes, and you would know this outside of me telling you, but sometimes jobs aren't very much fun.
What?
And I know, right?
I don't even, what? Yeah, as a reality TV star with an entourage, I don't even know. Me and Kim Kardashian have the best lives.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like that, but entirely different. And what usually happens is kids will say, well, I don't like this job, so I'm just going to quit. Well, that's fine, but there are going to be consequences to it. And usually you have to set the parameters. For example, if your boss is beating you, if you're not being paid, if the company goes under, there's some good ways that you should plan on letting kids out of it. But the same way that we know every child is different, you kind of have to set those rules up differently. And that was the point of the worksheet generally in saying that I can't possibly tell you that there's a silver bullet on how to fix any one scenario for kids because each child is different, each family is different, each parent's set of values are different. And because of that, you can't really have a specific rule that says never let your kid quit a job because there's probably some good life lessons in that. But make sure you know you're customizing it for each child. I've got three, and they're all dramatically different kids. So there's no silver bullet for my three, let alone for the gross population in general.
One of your other questions is, how will you teach your child to deal with business failure? How do you teach them how to do that? I mean, it's one thing to talk about it, but don't they need to actually make too much lemonade that doesn't sell and then they go into debt with the bank of dad and have to be foreclosed on or something?
Right. And again, it goes back to vaccination, right? So if you can allow them to fail, if you think about teaching them how to walk, you don't put them in a perfectly covered room and padded room and never let them fall and catch them before they land flat on their face. You need to let them do that a little bit. So how are you going to give them the understanding that after you fall flat on your face and after your lemonade stand goes chapter seven and you got to liquidate, how do you possibly get back up? And that lesson of getting back up is really the best thing you can teach your kids because they are going to trip and fall. And it's not about tripping and falling. It's about standing back up after you've failed and gone down.
Love it. Clint, thank you for your time today. I think our listeners will find you inspiring and also a little terrifying. You have a very high bar for this, and it's awesome. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Coming up on the Moolah La Book Club, Millennials and Money, how the challenges they face for getting a handle on their finances are more complex than any generation before them. And we'll take you through the Moolah La questionnaire. You can sign up for our newsletter at moolahla.ca and subscribe to the podcast version of this radio show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Money and millennials. Life is different for this generation in so many ways. Sure, they have opportunities that would have been unimaginable to their parents, but the challenges they face in getting a handle on their money are more significant and more complex than any generation before them. Beth Koblinger is the author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. She joins us now from New York City. Hello there.
Hello.
What are some of the challenges that this age bracket faces that their parents did not?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the student debt. The average student debt is $37,000 for people who borrowed. The median is $15,000, which is still a big chunk of change versus, it's triple the size of their parents' debt. And they worry about it. One study found that 56% of young people say they worry often or all the time about their debt load. So that's a real big challenge for
yeah. Our Canadian listeners are feeling grateful that the university education here is so much cheaper and there's other government assistance. But I think you're right in terms of the challenge. People do graduate with much more debt than generations right. before. The other thing I want to know right off the top is around the mindset of the millennial generation, because in lots of areas like career and how they consume and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of talk about who they are and how they behave. In your opinion, what is real and what isn't? What's just bluster?
Right, right. Well, I think what's real is this generation, in some ways, is more like maybe their grandparents or even great-grandparents, the Depression generation, in that they came of age at a time when the economic world around them was basically going down, and, you know, to no fault of their own, when it comes to the mortgage crisis and the recession, young people either saw their parents or their parents' friends or their relatives or neighbors losing their homes, losing their jobs. And I think that has made them more cautious. They save more. I mean, we have statistics that they're much more likely to save than baby boomers or Gen Xers when they were that age. And in fact, one study said that almost a third of them set aside more than 10% of their salary. So that sounds really good. And I think it is a lot more focused on thrift and just living life without consuming that much just because they don't have that much. Also, the, you know, the American dream, or maybe the Canadian dream to some extent too, is buying a home. And they, you know, saw their parents lose their home, or at least that generation where so many people in the United States lost their home, many of whom got into 0% down mortgages that they had no business being in. In my opinion, the banks really had no business giving them the loans in the first place. Now lenders are much more cautious, and they require people to put 20% down, a 20% down payment before they buy a home, which is much harder, a much harder goal to reach. So young
people, it's one of your tips. You actually flag it as think hard before buying a house or apartment. So it isn't just a simple rite of passage anymore, in your view.
Exactly. And, you know, the average age right now when someone buys that first home is 32, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, it was 26. So it's a really different, you know, 20s, if you say 30s, the new 20s, well, maybe that's true when it comes to buying a home, because people are really waiting and they need to save up more to get that home.
You argue that it is, quote, crazy not to think about retirement when you're in your 20s, end quote. Mm-hmm. How do you get that message through?
Right, right. Well, this generation, as we, you know, we see, they actually are getting it in the sense that 3/4 of millennials have been saving for retirement, that they really are taking advantage of 401ks if they have it at work, just because they're more cautious. And they also have less credit card debt, which is kind of amazing. That my generation, when we graduated from college, everyone got a credit card in college, and literally all you had to do was sign your name. There were, you know, credit card companies all over the college, right on the campus, handing out credit cards. And in 2009, President Obama changed the rules in a good way. He said you have to be 21 to get a credit card or have an income. I mean, what a concept. You need an income before you get a credit card, or have someone co-sign it who's responsible. And in that way, it made it more difficult, in a good way, for young people who had no money to get credit cards. So the generation, this generation, they are not carrying massive credit card debts at all. So that's another benefit, or at least a good checkpoint that they have in their column.
Mm. What is the role of parents, do you think, who have kids who are in their 20s and 30s? Certainly in their 20s, it is probable that the parents are involved in some way. I mean, you hear all those hilarious stories about parents calling the bosses of their kids to give them feedback on their work experience and all. Oh, my gosh. All those crazy, that helicopter parenting thing that has continued. What role do you think parents have in helping their kids get a financial life, assuming that they didn't do that work when the kid was 10 and, you know, put them on allowance and da-da-da-da-da?
Right. Paid attention, right. Well, that was my book that came out in February, Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not, which really spoke to how parents could talk to kids about money. But I do think that, well, one of the biggest repercussions, and not just the parents' fault, but the economy overall, is a 2016 Pew study found that a record 1/3 of young adults are now living with their parents. So they're moving back home, they're living with their parents, and their parents, I think, really have to lay the ground rules that, you know, if they're okay with them moving back home, that doesn't mean the parents are going to be supporting them to a level at which they became accustomed when they were in high school, because that they really want to not enable a grown child to keep you know, either living on credit card debt or not getting a job or not saving for the future. And I think setting some concrete milestones with a grown kid, like, you know, well, you should be saving an emergency cushion. You should be saving money in your savings account. You know, in the next year, you should definitely be working on a bunch of different jobs. It may not be your dream job, but you have to make a living. And if you expect your kids to contribute to your household, whether it's the bills or, you know, paying rent, then you have to tell them up front. And even putting these things in writing is important.
Besides, the parents need that basement bedroom for their grow up. Like, how are they going to deal with that space? There's a cost to it.
It's true.
How should financial advisors engage with this demographic? Because once you're in your 20s or 30s, you actually could have a reasonable nest egg. You could be focused on retirement and engaging professional support on that. What do they need to do differently than managing a Gen X or a boomer client?
Right. I think that this generation is really concerned with doing what they can to live a good lifestyle, but they're not even, you know, of course, this is a gross generalization, but I do think that there's not a sense of we're going to hit it really big. You know, my generation, people came out, they were yuppies. I mean, I don't know if you remember that term, but there were people who
professionals.
Everybody, young professionals, people trying to get ahead and make it on Wall Street. And that's just not, you know, it's more of I'm going to come up with an app and I'm going to work independently. And I think what this generation needs to focus on, and maybe somebody who's marketing to them, is if you're going to live in this gig economy and be an entrepreneur or a freelancer or whatever it's labeled as, you really need to do all those things that you're not being given anymore. Employers would give health insurance and generous 401k matching plans or even pensions, like guaranteed pensions. And that doesn't exist for anyone in the workplace anymore. But people still get, you know, you can maybe get some life insurance or you get, you know, disability insurance or a flexible spending account. These are all things you get if you work for an employer. So by not working for an employer, you really need to make sure to take a Roth IRA each year and make sure you have health insurance and all those things that you may not be being provided for. You have to make sure to get them.
Right. Beth, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's great.
Beth Koebleiner is the author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. As you probably could tell, she joined us from New York City, not because she's so groovy and funky or looking out across the Hudson, but because she talked about 401ks and Roth IRAs and things like that. The equivalent here, RRSP on this side of the border. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and sometimes a little bit about life. Joining us to answer these questions is Harold Pollack. He is one of the authors behind the Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. So, Harold, just the first thing that comes to your mind. I'm not going to make this complicated. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
How would you describe your money personality?
Boring.
Really? What do you mean by boring? Do you mean you buy boring stuff or you're so just predictable when it comes to your money?
I'm totally predictable. Every time anyone asks me, should I do this thing? I always say no.
Yeah.
My investments would fit on four lines on an index card. I give all kinds of financial advice, but I never change my portfolio or do anything exciting ever.
Do you have any guilty spending pleasures?
I do. Sweet camera lenses.
Oh, what? Sweet camera lenses? That's not a brand. That's a description of a camera lens.
No, that's a description and a price. I have never had a hobby that I like to spend money on until the last year and a half. I'm really, really cheap. You know, I drive a beater car, all this kind of stuff. And then I suddenly became really addicted to photography, and I lust after these gigantic camera lenses that can cost, you know, thousands of dollars. And I typically don't buy anything like that, but I look at it longingly all the time. And they follow me on the internet. When I go to the New York Times, a camera lens pops up in the upper right corner, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So that's my, I don't want to tell anybody about that.
Don't tell anybody. And I won't tell anybody either. But I will say, when it comes to guilty spending pleasures, that is much cheaper than fast cars or cocaine. So hooray for you that you chose one that costs a couple
thousand.
Really
happy. my wife is really happy. This is my midlife crisis. And yeah. I'm always giving her newspaper clips of people who have worse midlife crises than involve other things.
Well played. Well played. Okay, so what does financial freedom mean to you?
You know, the best thing is that I'm more relaxed. I have less anxiety. That is the first reward that you get. Once I got on a budget and I wasn't, you know, managing my monthly cash flow, I could be sane and I could make long-term plans and I could relax. That's by far the biggest reward of all the financial stuff that one does.
When do you plan to retire and what will you do? And I know you're a prof, so you probably get some juicy pension and sabbatical years that you can spend in Tuscany. So this question is especially relevant for you.
Oh, they're going to take me out feet first from my office.
Right.
I don't understand that question at all. That's if I retired, my wife would kill me. Because I would be too annoying around the house.
Right.
But my plan is feet first out of the office.
Who was your money mentor and what did they teach you?
That's a good question. Well, I had money mentors that I didn't listen to. My PhD advisor, Richard Zeckhauser at Harvard, is a very wise person who is very wise about psychology and is very wise about economics. And if I had only listened to him about 10 years before I started to seriously save my money, I'd be rich now. He was really my money mentor. I would say that number two would be the behavioral economist like Richard Thaler. And then I would say number three would be my sister Gail, who's just very, very frugal. And she is a great role model for how to actually live economically on a budget.
What is one money topic you could write about, talk about every single day without getting bored? And then I'm going to ask you, what is one topic you wish you never, ever had to write about, talk about ever again? So what is one that has your passion so deeply infused that you could regale people with tales of this particular topic until the early hours of the morning?
I would say how unbelievably bad we all are at playing the stock market. And all the evidence, and you know, we think that it's the guys sitting in their basement in their pajamas who are frantically day trading, watching Jim Cramer, who are the problem. It's everybody. There's all these studies that exist that show like the stocks that we sell do better than the stocks that we buy with the money that we just got from the stocks that we sold. And there's just an incredible literature that's just really underscoring that we are just all so bad at playing the stock market. It's almost hilarious. So that's a topic that I could talk about a lot. A topic that I could also talk about that no one else ever wants me to talk about is how to invest our university endowment. I have bored more people with that, and I won't bore you now, but I could put you under the table in a narcoleptic stupor.
You're more effective than tryptophan. Okay, so what's one topic you hate that you wish you never had to talk about again?
I would say anything that involves annuities that just gets really intricate and it's important, but God, I hate to spend the time on it. That's one thing, and I hate bargaining over cars and dealing with which is important, but the experience is so horrible that I could just drive my car into the ground if I never have to go into another dealership.
Would you bargain over a really fantastic camera lens?
Oddly enough, I don't. And here's why. I love going to camera stores where there's some old guy who's really into photography and who's got all these eccentric opinions, like he won't sell me something that I want to pay him for because it's not what he would buy.
Right.
And he usually charges me a little more than the internet would. And I kind of want to just pay him because I want to come in and talk to him.
Yeah.
So I don't bargain over that stuff because it's part of the club.
Yeah. It's like entertainment. And you want him to stay in business because if it all moves to the net, who's going to talk to the curmudgeonly guy with all these crazy rules about what you're allowed to buy and not buy?
That's exactly. Central Camera Chicago, they are so awesome and they're so hilarious. I went in to buy something one day. He's like, why do you want to buy that? He pulls out a handkerchief and he says, you see your old one? You wipe it with this. It's called the handkerchief. He like doesn't want to take my money. So he needs my financial advice, but I need his camera advice. So it works out.
It's a good trade. Harold, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It was a fun conversation.
And good luck with your photography habit / hobby. Harold Pollack is one of the authors behind The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. That is our program for today. It's our special book club edition of Moolala. You can drop us a line with books that you would like to suggest we include the next time we do this. ask@moolala.ca is our email address. You can also find me at Bruce Selry on Twitter or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. To listen to past episodes of the radio show, they are archived in a bunch of places on our website, moolala.ca, or on iTunes. You can listen to past episodes, the full radio show, write a review. You can even subscribe, so the next episode is just going to show up on your device magically. We appreciate you joining us today. Happy reading, and have a great day.